And welcome to everybody on Off the Hook Overtime. Think we all made it over. Do we still have Raphael with us, Rob?
We do indeed.
Awesome. Great conversation, guys. Great conversation on Pegasus. And glad we were able to get the word out about Virgil and everything. And I'm told we're actually on the air on YouTube, which is great. That's amazing. Everything is working. We didn't tweet out the link until just now, I understand. So it's possible not very many people know we're here yet. So maybe we should wait just a little bit for people to
It's
on the main page. That's true. Who am I telling? I'm telling people that already know because they're listening. We need to tell the people who aren't listening.
Made me feel better.
All right. Our phone number, for those of you who want to call us, you can do that now, is 802-321-4225. That's 802-321-HACK. It's a Vermont area code, but we're not in Vermont. Yeah, that's just the number we happen to get.
And the slim line is set to high.
Uh-huh. Oh, you mean the ringer is set to high. Okay, so we won't have any trouble hearing the actual phone ring. That's good. Okay. Raphael, so anything else that you wanted to add about Pegasus or the shady figures that are behind an NSO group or governments or corporations or things like that?
No, I think that this is just such a fantastic story to keep an eye on. I say fantastic, but you know, like a lot of fantastic stories, the underlying fact pattern is actually quite disturbing. But you know, one of the researchers who's been involved in this, a guy named John Scott Railton, he said something on Twitter that I thought was something that we should all keep in mind, which is that, you know, if heads of state can't keep themselves safe, what hope do we have?
Absolutely,
right?
Absolutely. Yeah, that is scary, and just the fact that we can be targeted so easily, and never even know that there was an attempt made. Is there a simple way to find out if you have been targeted? If you're not a government leader or a leading journalist, if you're just somebody who you think, you know, maybe I've been involved in human rights issues or something, or I might have annoyed the wrong person. How would someone ever find out?
So I think that as far as this list that we were talking about on the show is concerned, this list of, you know, 50,000 odd telephone numbers that have been pre-selected for targeting, you know, as per these media reports, I would get in touch with Amnesty. You know, Amnesty International's major human rights organization, for the listeners who don't know it, it has a decades-long history of fighting against the death penalty and torture and other abuses, and has lately begun flexing its muscles in the digital sphere. If you get in touch with Amnesty and you supply them your bona fides and your telephone number, my understanding is that they are quite overwhelmed right now with people getting in touch with them to ask them that very question. But no harm in asking, and you never know. Maybe you could be a winner.
And, you know, I understand that some of the governments that are accused of spying on journalists are now suing those very same journalists and activists that are looking into this. So the story just keeps getting more and more bizarre.
Yeah, I you know, I'm not aware of the ins and outs of it, and I haven't seen the text of the lawsuit, but I have seen the reporting out of France about the Moroccan government suing the French that were allegedly targeted. In India, you have also seen various forms of retaliation against people who have covered this story in various ways. In fact, one of the Indian newspapers, an online newspaper called The Wire, which is quite punchy and does a lot of investigative work, they were visited by police a few days ago. Allegedly, you know, they sent out a tweet saying like, "Oh, how odd! Police came to see if our paperwork was in order." You know, and what interesting timing. After they published, you know, a bunch of really, you know, explosive stories about domestic surveillance in India, and then the Indian police said, "Well, actually, you know, the signpost outside of your building was not visible, so we came to check out, you know, who the building belonged to." Yeah.
That makes all the sense in the world. Wow.
Sure. Yeah, exactly.
What kind of first of all, let me give out the phone number again. Our phone lines are open, 802-321-4225. We'd like to hear from you either on these stories or on other stories, things that you like to bring up. We're here for you during overtime, 802-321-4225. Rafael, let me just ask you, what kind of response have you seen to this story from readers, from the public at large?
Well, look, it's important to note that, you know, I've not been directly involved, so I'm not one of the media organizations that have been working with Forbidden Stories on this. I'm just a Pegasus watcher who has been, you know, kind of keeping track of the story for these 5 years or so. I note with some jealousy because I'm, you know, I wasn't behind this latest batch of revelations, that these stories have moved the dial in a way that previous revelations have not. And I think that that's often what happens when you are able to put faces and names to targets of cyber espionage. I think that that's what this story has done that so many other stories about spyware and about Pegasus in particular have not managed to do, or not managed to do at this scale, let's say.
Wow. We have a phone call. I think I heard the phone ringing a second ago. Is anybody out there? Good evening.
Hello. This is Phil from Missouri again.
Phil from Missouri. How you doing?
I'm okay. Having a show with mods, so I caused my health problems, but...
Sorry to hear that.
All right.
Any questions for Rafael from Reuters or anything about what we were talking about tonight?
Well, you know, when is spying, well, domestic spying, when is it justified? I mean, there's got to be at least a little bit of justification to cut down on terrorism and so forth, right? Some legitimate reasons for it.
I believe that's how it's marketed, because that's exactly what they are allegedly trying to do.
Yeah. The thing with the malware on phones thing, with companies actually selling this stuff now, sell malware, don't you think maybe we should, like, have some kind of international treaty to prosecute on that kind of stuff? You know, malware, as its basic thing, is just pretty much just a kid prank, right? But the only reason it's destructive is because it attacks servers and stuff like that and deletes data or corrupts it or does something like ransomware. But, you know, we got to have some kind of common sense consensus on how to deal with this stuff. Out here in Missouri, they keep talking about having a cyber criminal court system to try to... you know, make the penalties for any laws broken at least fit the crime. You know what I mean?
Uh huh.
It's kind of hard because, you know, we need some kind of surveillance to look out for the bad guys, right?
Yeah. Well.
But it should be done with a warrant.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, and this is actually something I wanted to ask Rafael because you know we do have these kinds of investigative tools. But there's a trail, you know, a paper trail, there's warrants, things like that. This seems to be bypassing all of that. Is that a fair assessment? Rafael, are you there?
You know, it's hard to say on that. I think that I, like a lot of other people, think that any law enforcement action should be justified, proportionate, and wherever possible, reviewed by an independent and impartial judge, right? I think that that's kind of core bedrock of of the American judicial system, or at least it should be. And I don't know what's happening with the NSO spyware or with other spyware, by the way. I just don't know. The fact that I don't know and that others don't know is kind of a concern in and of itself, right? Police need a warrant to get into your home. Shouldn't they need a warrant to get into your phone? I think that's an interesting question. I definitely think that that's worthy of concern.
Inherent in this, I think, is a huge scope creep from maybe the mission of international terrorism and sort of how we're changing and morphing definitions. It seems even NSO's business model itself was on was based on sort of the proliferation of counterterrorism and contractors and privatization around that, right?
I mean, you know, I don't know exactly. You know, NSO has, of course, made some claims about, well, our technology is used to fight terrorism. I have not yet seen a single case in which we have a confirmed use of Pegasus technology to catch terrorists. You know, I've not seen a single named case. Now, that could be because of the, you know, sensitivities involved. That's, you know, that's possible. But yeah, I mean, you're right to identify that rhetoric as something that's used often. I just don't know if in practice that's the case, and not because I'm necessarily skeptical. I would be almost certain that such technology would be used against, you know, terrorists and other associated bad guys, if it could be. I just haven't seen any evidence of that, and that's I don't know, that's a little bit thought provoking.
But it's always used as the excuse, the reason to do something that's invasive, but then it's always, without exception, used against others.
Look, I don't think I'm as categorical as you are on that score, but you know, I certainly sympathize with that perspective, because mm-hmm. you do often see mission creep with this kind of technology, very often indeed.
Caller from Missouri, any other questions?
Oh, nothing to think of, but glad to have you guys back. Have something live to listen to.
Hi. Well, we're glad you're out there.
All right, you have a good one, okay?
All right, you take care.
Bye.
And our phone number, once again, 802-321-4225. Somebody was calling during that call, because somehow we see caller ID even on call waiting, and they were masking their caller ID, so it just showed up as zero. I want to talk to that person.
It's the operator.
The operator's calling us. The operator is calling us. The same
and you
operator,
can't hang up.
The same operator that backheld me when I was 8. Oh, my God.
Well, they have more time now. Uh-huh. You know, they're not as busy. There's, you know, automation and stuff.
802-321-HACK, off the hook, overtime. And I do believe I hear the phone ringing.
Yes, the trim line
is
speaking.
I'm so glad you turned that up. Wow. Maybe we can pick it up now. This is a private caller, so it's not the same. But go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Emmanuel.
Is this Rebel?
Yeah.
Wow, it's
Rebel.
Can
you turn up the volume? Could you turn up the volume? Because on my computer, I have the volume all the way up, and it. Your volume is not very high, so...
Really?
Okay, you're not alone, Rebel. I've been battling this. I've been looking at the board. There was... We've been trying to even things out, but... And there was some suggestion things were a little hot in the past, but...
Yeah, people told us we were too loud, so
we'll look into it.
We turned it down. Now we're too low. We can never make everybody happy.
We're just trying to find a nice sweet spot.
And Junes, if you're out there, you're the person who processes our shows and puts them online, maybe up the volume a little bit so this won't seem like a problem to anybody in the future. All right? That's how you solve things. Rebel, how have you been? Raphael's sake, Rebel has been calling this radio show for longer than it's been on somehow. And we haven't heard from him in a long time. He's the guy that discovered that you could make free phone calls in chemical bank ATMs.
Back in the 90s when they used to have, well, I was going to mention that, you know, it wasn't ATMs. It was, they used to have just a regular phone in the branches there.
Right.
That you used to just call customers. Like you could, it was just a regular phone anyone could just dial.
And
but
now they don't have that. They don't have chemical bank. They don't have any of that stuff. What have you been up to lately?
Well, I mean, I was just, you know, on things that they don't have anymore. I was just thinking of the things that are happening with the virus and all these things that I was just wondering, I mean, not wondering, but, you know, what would happen if this virus came about in, like, 2000 or 2001 or...
Oh, that's a very good question.
Before Zoom and before smartphones and before, you know... any of the things that we have today.
Yeah, it's called the Spanish flu from 1919, and which, by the way, was not from Spain. It was from Kansas, or allegedly from Kansas. Yeah, you know, having this degree of technology made it much more painless. Even 20 years ago, it would have been much more of a challenge to have our kids go to school and to be in touch with each other. So, I don't know how we would have handled that.
I maintain there will still be modes and methods and a variety of options to communicate. So I think all of those would probably have been deployed just as people were, thinking about setting up ways to use video conferencing and so forth for their own work and life.
We always tell ourselves that we can't possibly survive without the technology we have presently, but we always have. And people would have read more books, perhaps, or just done more things that didn't involve the kind of technology we're used to now. I guarantee 20 years from now, people will wonder how we ever kept sane, assuming that's what we're doing.
Right, so, but we didn't have Zoom, and we didn't have smartphones, and we didn't have some of the
search engines.
We didn't have search engines.
We had BBSs, and we had newspapers.
Right,
we had all kinds of cool things.
2000 and 1995 and all.
If you get teleported back to that period, it's hard. But if you are living in that period already, it's what you're used to. So that's how people.
I miss payphones.
Okay, well that came out of nowhere. But yeah, I miss payphones too. I think we all do.
And I miss operators, that used to do things like collect calls and person-to-person calls but time and charges and all.
All that stuff. But somehow, Rebel, people still send us tons of payphone pictures for the magazine, and we have no shortage of that. So I don't know where they're finding them. They're still around. Most of them don't work.
But they don't work.
No, but they're still relics, and they still look pretty cool.
Yeah, they do. I mean, let's see. Do you remember? I remember back in the 70s or maybe the 80s. Back in the bill system days, one could pick up a payphone and dial a number or dial the operator and say, "This is a police call," and give them four digits, which would be a badge number, then they put it through.
Wow! And I've heard of that. I think you told me this, and
I don't think I told you that because I don't think I even mentioned it.
And you know what? I remember you telling me something about having operator privilege.
Right, that's when the operators used to not be able to dial, when they used to not connect you with 800 numbers.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then you just say, like, I have dial operator privileges because I'm, like, disabled or whatever, and then they would put it through.
And that's all you had to do. That's all you had to say.
Right.
Amazing. Right. Raphael, a rebel, would definitely be very interested in the 1940s phone hacking. As you can see, there's so many people in our community that I've been following.
If Raphael from Reuters wants to contact me, to do a story or whatever. Is Raphael a Reuters newspaper or news video news?
Have you ever read Reuters newspaper, Rebel? Have you ever gotten a copy of Reuters newspaper?
I mean, these days, you don't know. I mean, Reuters can, you see video
Reuters stories,
you hear it on the radio.
Reuters stories appear in newspapers, obviously, but, Reuters, well, I guess, Raphael, you can probably explain Reuters better than I can.
Oh, I don't know about that. Rebel, first of all, I'm always happy to have a chat. Second of all, as far as Reuters is concerned, it's a news agency, and it exists. I think most people these days will interact with it online. Traders and financial professionals might interact with it through the terminal because Reuters appears on icon terminals. But I think for most people who kind of go about, and who are out and about in the world, it's they'll interact with Reuters either through their local newspaper, which will pick up some Reuters copy, or through the internet. You go to Reuters.com, and that's where you see our stories.
Okay, well, if you ever want to do a story with me on, the past and things, how things worked, and I don't know.
And if you do a story like that, Raphael, be sure to come to us for perspective and rebuttal.
Yeah, of course.
I'd be happy to. That sounds great.
All right. Hey, Rebel, we hope to see you at a 2600 meeting again sometime, hopefully.
Oh, yeah. When else? I mean, they've been online, or not online, but the building is being rebuilt and all that other stuff.
Okay, Rob can update us on all of that.
Yeah, we're still doing them. We did our first in-person 2600 meeting this month, this very month, at the beginning of the month, and we're going to be doing it again. So check out nyc2600.net for all the info on where we're meeting, how we're meeting, and everything. It's not where it used to be. It's not at Citigroup anymore because they are still building that place. The remodeling work is years behind schedule, but we've been meeting around
now.
The corner, and it's happening again.
And if you have a meeting in your vicinity or would like to start one, please either tweet at us. We have a Twitter account just for that purpose. It's called 2600 Meetings, the numbers 2600 Meetings. Or you can write to us, meetings@2600.com. You can also visit the website, 2600.com/meetings, to see where the current meetings are. We're starting from scratch. We're not just simply putting all the meetings back. There's certain criteria we have to meet, a total vaccination rate of at least 40% in your area. And we have to hear from you. We have to hear that there's actual people there. And then we will put the meeting list back up on our website and in the magazine. So
I've been fully vaccinated. So
you've been fully, well. Good to hear. That's very good to hear.
And by the way, I'm going to be going to Europe in a couple of weeks.
Oh wow! Okay. Well, good luck with that, and be careful because there are some places that are still hotspots.
Right. Yeah, I know.
So. Take lots of pictures.
Yes, please. Of payphones.
Yeah, lots of pictures and video. They'll be going to Amsterdam and London and you know Germany.
Have you been there before?
I've been to Portugal and I've been to Ukraine.
Oh, that's an interesting combination.
Well, 3 years ago I went to Portugal. Last year I went to Ukraine because that was basically the only place I could go at that time, and it was kind of interesting because you can't get into Russia without a visa.
I'm trying to understand, how is Ukraine the only place you could go at any time?
I know the feeling.
Well, no, you don't need a visa in advance to go to Ukraine.
Okay, I guess that was true last year. I didn't know that.
Right, but I mean, you had to be, you know, you had to take a COVID-19 test and do all of that. But it was very interesting. I really liked Ukraine. It was a very interesting city, and I really liked it. Very Soviet type, and the tours were good, and the people giving the tours, and the restaurants were good, and the museums.
You went to Kiev, I take it.
I went to Kiev.
No, that's a great city. I like it. It's a very hilly city and very scenic, and it's great. It really is. I do recommend it. Rebo, great hearing from you again. Please stay in touch, and I hope to see you at a meeting sometime.
Yeah, of course.
All right, take care.
Okay, bye.
Wow, so cool to hear from Rebel.
Yeah, safe travels.
Yeah, it's amazing. Rafael, I know we've been talking a lot about this particular story, about Pegasus, but are there any other stories that that you think we should be focusing on these days?
Man, so many.
Yeah, well, any that you're working on.
Yeah, hard to say. I and my colleagues have been on a big kick about mercenary hackers, and I guess that you could say that NSO is a kind of mercenary hacking group themselves. Mm-hmm. But there's a whole universe, right, of hackers who are operating more or less professionally, more or less openly, providing their services to governments, to spy agencies, and sometimes even to private organizations, private citizens, and digging into that field is just fascinating. If any of your listeners know anything about that, that's what I'm really into these days.
I guess you kind of call that the white hat hacking. I hate the terminology, I really do, but a lot of people market it that way and say that you have to be an ethical hacker in the corporate world. To me, every hacker has ethics, so it's kind of an insult to even say that. I think everyone believes they're the good guys. Everyone believes that they're helping out by doing what they do. But it's interesting how some are demonized and some are praised. And, we've seen this evolve over the decades.
Yeah. Yeah, and I don't know. I also have trouble with this kind of white hat, black hat, gray hat kind of, stuff. It's especially because some of these hackers who are working for law enforcement agencies and intelligence services, I think as we've seen with some of the coverage around the Pegasus stuff, but also in other cases, they end up going after good people and hacking good people. And that, do they still count as white hats at that point? I don't know. I don't think so.
Yeah, I think their hat gets a little dirty at that point. But
I think so.
I like to call myself a no-hat hacker, even though I do wear a hat, though, but it's not a particular color. What do you think of this Freedom phone? By the way, let me give out the phone number again, 802-321-4225. It's it's targeting the MAGA crowd, and supposedly it had a huge amount of red flags. Are you familiar with this?
I've seen the coverage. This is not something that I've looked into in any kind of detail, but I saw a few security experts really tear into it. It seems like a bit of a joke in some ways, but if it's being marketed as kind of a new and amazing piece of surveillance technology, I think that
you know, those kinds of extraordinary claims require extraordinary proof, and I've seen a lot of evidence to the contrary.
Yeah, it's a $500 smartphone. It's aimed at the MAGA crowd. It's the latest attempt to build an alternate tech platform for right-wingers, but this time with a smartphone instead of social media. It was announced back in March. The tagline was, "A phone made for conservatives by conservatives." Okay, whatever. The device is being hawked by Eric Finman, the self-described world's youngest Bitcoin millionaire. That doesn't make me like you. It doesn't make me look up to you in any way. The phone is supposed to ship in August, so that's coming up just around the corner. The Freedom Phone's feature set is about what you would expect. The company, which seems to also be called Freedom Phone, claims to have made an uncensorable app store that won't ban Gab and Parler the way Google and Apple did. I don't know why they didn't just come up with an app store. Freedom OS is a free speech first operating system that the company claims to have developed, and it says the hardware is comparable to the best smartphones on the market. Based on the information that Freedom Phone has released so far, almost none of that appears to be true. This article, of course, comes from Ars Technica. We'll get into it a little bit more, but I think we have a caller. Do we have a caller on the line?
You do. It's Nathan in Australia.
Australia. Wow. What time is it over there?
It's 10:25 a.m. in the mysterious future.
And yeah, it's what, Thursday over there, right?
Yep. Thursday morning. Yep.
Wow. So what's on your mind tonight? Or I'm sorry, this morning.
I just rang to say good day, but I was going to say before, I didn't hear the show, but I saw the tweets about overtime, so I thought I'd listen in. A couple of things. What a blast from the past hearing Rebel on the line. I've got more to say about that, but I won't. I was thinking about the journalism story, and I was thinking about how often Australians don't think about how, like in the US, you have your Bill of Rights sort of stuff and all your constitutional amendments, you know, First Amendment and all the different ones about search and seizure and stuff. And I think often, like, people forget that down here, we don't actually have that in our laws. So so journalists and so on and other people can easily be sort of scooped up in intelligence gathering and raids of documents and seizure and stuff like that, and have, you know, very little recourse because sometimes the laws have been passed through the parliament and people don't really take much interest in it, and they just sort of get through and without little resistance. Whereas in the US, you know, you have a lot of people very very stridently sort of defending those rights to things like free speech and, you know, and unlawful search and so on. So, yeah, I just thought I'd mention that, like, it's not all third world dictatorships and so on that can have problems with that. Even seemingly free countries like Australia can have troubles with that.
Raphael, have you heard much as far as an Australian connection to all of this?
No, not as far as the NSO and Pegasus is concerned, but maybe the caller can help refresh my memory. Wasn't there an Australian journalist who published some leaked material and got into a lot of hot water recently?
Oh, I think I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, it has happened. I don't remember the particulars, but I think it may have even been like our national broadcaster, the ABC,
that's
journalist,
right, yeah,
they've had like raids, and they've had it when, and sometimes it can be hard to tell, you know, whether it's a politically motivated raids or not, like when they leak something about the government and then all of a sudden the federal police turn up and want to figure out where the raid came from. You can't always tell, you know, whether the law enforcement are just trying to enforce the laws or whether they've been leaned on by the government or not. And like, I think we tend to give them the benefit of the doubt here and don't really think that our law enforcement are too influenced by the government, but it's really hard to tell.
So, Raphael, you weren't referring to Julian Assange. I thought you were.
No, I wasn't, although, I mean, oh boy,
you talked about somebody leaking from Australia who got into a lot of trouble. I mean, come on.
Yeah, no, that's right. I suppose I should have clarified. No, I think that I was referring to the same case that Jacala was referring to. There was this journalist who I think was raided by police over disclosure, and it ignited a big debate about press freedom in Australia. I don't know enough. I've never been, and I've only very rarely covered stories out of Australia, so I'm not really qualified to talk about this kind of stuff.
We had a great one a couple of years back where
I'd rather have the Bill of Rights
than not. Technology yeah. journalists that have played them at their own game when they were bringing in metadata retention laws. This is probably like 5 years ago at least, it might even be longer. And the journalist said, okay, from our one of our main telcos, okay, I'd like to request my metadata because that's my right. And they didn't know how to do it, and they ended up providing him with like folders and folders and folders of information, like, and it went on and on, like, you know, where he was trying to, the government had passed these laws but without really like thinking about how the telcos would comply if a normal citizen wanted their metadata as opposed to law enforcement requesting metadata.
Right. There's similar rules, you know, that are in place in Europe in terms of, automatic retention of metadata. And those are the kinds of things that, you know, I've always looked askance at. Metadata can be incredibly telling.
And then I'd
love to learn more about this Australian case, in particular about the ability to request it, because that's the kind of thing that you can normally do through GDPR in the European Union. Something that, you know, if the Americans listening in on this program don't know about it, I urge you to look it up, because it's a very powerful tool for getting data that's held on you. And little by little, you're seeing similar laws being introduced in the United States, including the California Consumer Privacy Act. And maybe one day a national privacy legislation will allow us to get some of that stuff too.
Yeah, it's emerging very, very slowly, but at the state level. And often that is how larger movements like this occur, as soon as a groundswell of states have come up with plans and implemented stuff that's, you know, more or less successful or popular, that that then it takes on sort of more a national emphasis. We're seeing that a little bit more with like right to repair stuff, mm-hmm. where a lot of states are really looking at it more seriously, and it's going to start making a lot more sense as the people start realizing the impacts and implications.
Yeah, on the subject of requesting records, I don't know if this still happens, but I know in England, or at least in London, you can request your every time you appear on CCTV. Raphael, have you heard about this?
Yeah. That's right. That's true. Very, very rarely employed, but it is theoretically possible.
Yeah, that's something I'd like to pursue.
Did you guys do a thing? I feel like years and years ago there was one where, or maybe it was at CCC or somewhere, where somebody had made a short film using that sort of thing.
That they'd sounds
put
like
themselves yeah. in all different places, and then they'd made all the requests for all the corresponding times. Edited it all together into a short film.
Yeah, that's brilliant. That's exactly the kind of thing I would expect hackers to do. Come up with a plot and everything. Wow.
Anyway, I'll get off the line and I'll keep listening. And great to hear you guys.
Okay, happy Thursday to you, and hope to see you sometime at Hope or us in Australia or something like that. It's great to hear from the other side of the world.
Yeah, thanks for listening.
All right, take care.
See ya. Bye.
And our phone number again, 802-321-4225, 802-321-HACK. Continuing with this Freedom Phone, this right-wing Freedom Phone that's being introduced. I kind of want to get one. Kind of want to just have a Freedom Phone around.
Now, the French fry thing didn't work. They're going into phones now.
The phone has, going back to the Ars Technica story, the phone has so many red flags, it's difficult to know where to start. The website lists almost no information about the device itself. There's the name, a picture, and a price, but there's no spec sheet of any kind. This is a $500 phone, and its website gives you no indication of what you're actually buying. Actually, $500 phone, that's cheap these days, right? I mean, it's crazy that I even say that, but
it's probably even cheaper, and they're marking it up.
People pay $1,000 for phones. I'm using the same phone I used for the last, like, 8 years probably, which might put me outside of the reach of things like Pegasus. I don't know.
Well, a lot of them are lasting longer.
Not mine. No, mine's all messed up.
Well, I put lasting in gigantic quotations, but existing in a more or less functional state. But also, yeah, like $800 to $1,200, people don't balk at that. Maybe $600, that's like normal to people buying phones.
I don't get it, but whatever. Considering I spend most of my time cursing at the phone, why would I spend... Whatever. The front page of the website looks normal, but every button that should say something like learn more and link to more information instead says buy it now. If you didn't know it was a right-wing phone, now you do. There are 10 buy it now links placed all over the front of the website. Oh, I got to go to this website. And almost no important information about the phone. Plenty of manufacturers publish incomplete teaser pages for upcoming phones, but they don't collect the full retail price from customers without providing detailed spec information first. Yes, but considering who we're dealing with here, these are the people that would click on support Trump sites and have the option to pay once or pay forever every single month changed for them and didn't complain about it. Rob, go ahead.
The whole idea of this being a $500 phone and that being cheap for now is extra funny when you look at the bit of information that has come out in a lot of stories about this phone, where people are fairly sure it is a phone called the Umidigi A9 Pro that can be bought from AliExpress for as little as $119.
Hey, hang on a sec. What's it called again? The what?
Umidigi A9 Pro.
I don't want to make assumptions here, but that doesn't sound like it came from Ohio.
No, apparently it comes from China. Friend to America, China. And they sell these in bulk. You can get custom logos on them. You can get whatever branding you like. And it's very easy. It's the sort of thing that lots of companies do, including, I guess, our pals at Freedom Phone.
Not that there's anything wrong with it, but the Freedom Phone, marketed by conservative right wingers, is Chinese.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Well, that's something. Anyone buying a Freedom Phone is basically doing it sight unseen. You'd better really trust this upstart phone manufacturer. Because if you don't like what you receive, you're out of luck. The frequently asked question states, if the device is already opened, we do not offer returns at this time. Other manufacturers stand behind their products. They're going to try something new. So, yeah, Freedom Phone, coming to an angry person near you. Okay, so should we take any more calls? Phone lines are open still? Okay, 802-321-4225. And by the way, Raphael, don't feel like you're sentenced to be with us until 10. You're welcome to, or 9 rather. You're welcome to, skip out anytime you need to.
I may make a graceful or graceless exit, but I appreciate you guys having me on, and hope to chat with you guys again sometime soon.
Yeah, we appreciate you. We've actually cited your work a number of times on the show, so it's an honor to talk to you.
Sweet.
And any closing words as a journalist, as a Reuters reporter, that you wish to leave with people? Perhaps something that they don't know about the whole world of reporting, what you guys have been going through in the past few years, anything at all?
Oh, yeah. I don't know. I mean, for those of your listeners who don't know reporters or don't know reporting very well, it's easy to demystify. You've got a story, talk to a reporter about it. And if you think that a story is wrong, a lot of people will read stuff in the press and they'll tear their hair out and say, like, this is ridiculous. How could the reporter get it so wrong? Don't hesitate to get in touch. Some reporters are thin-skinned, but I'd like to think that, many aren't. And if you see a reporter writing about a technical topic and you think that they're kind of misunderstanding something, these are people and they're reachable. So send them a line. Whether you've got a story or you think a story shouldn't be a story, be in touch.
That is so true. We've talked to many reporters. Many of them get the story wrong. You seem to be somebody who does their research and understand, have the basics of the technology down. And that makes such a huge difference, to any story, but particularly in the world of technology. Go ahead, Rob.
And Raphael, for people who are listening and are interested in your work and want to get in touch or reach out, where can they do that?
Well, luckily, I'm the only Raphael Satter around. So if you just go to raphaelsatter.com, you've got about a zillion different ways of reaching me. I think most reporters these days, they live on Twitter. So if that's probably the easiest way to reach me. DMs are open. But otherwise, you know, just give me a Google. You'll find my website. They're about, you can send me an email. You can even send me, probably find me on, you know, Weibo, you know, VKontakt, Facebook, whatever your poison is. You can reach me there.
That's Raphael with a P-H, Satter, S-A-T-T-E-R.
That's exactly right.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight. And
thanks for having me, guys.
Hope we'll talk to you again soon. Take care. Raphael from Reuters. Great to have him with us.
Fantastic. Yeah, I love the perspective, and we absolutely would welcome more conversation in the future. There are so many stories out there. I love that even Rebel saw this and has so many stories to tell, I'm sure, and that would, I hope, be
Fruitful
connection. Yeah.
Missouri Rebel, who basically isn't defined by location, and Australia. That's really awesome. If there's anyone else out there who wants to call us, this is your last chance. 802-321-4225. We'll sign off if we don't get any more calls. Let me get into another story very, very briefly here, which is, you know, we're watching the Olympics, or some of us are watching the Olympics. In what is at least so far the biggest cybersecurity blunder of the Tokyo Olympics, an Italian TV announcer did not realize he was on air when he asked for the password for his computer. Do you know the password for the computer in this commentator booth? He asked during the broadcast of the Turkey-China volleyball game. So find that on your DVR if you need the password. Apparently not realizing he was still on air. He complained it was too hard to call the password Pippo, Pluto, or Topolino, he complained, referring to the Italian names for Goofy, Pluto, and Mickey Mouse. The snafu was immortalized in a video posted on Twitter by cybersecurity associate professor Stefano Zanero, who works at the Polytechnic University of Milan, and apparently likes to make fun of people. A source who works at Eurosport, the channel which was broadcasting the volleyball game, confirmed that the video is authentic. And so is the password. A colleague of the announcer can be heard in the background saying the password depends on the Olympics organizers, and asking the announcer if it's on a paper or posted close by. Turns out the password was booth.03, capital B, O-T-H, .03, after the number of the commentator's booth. So, you know, it's likely that all the passwords are the numbers of the commentator's booth, just pointing that out. Even the dot to make it more complicated, as if it was NASA's computer, he said on the air. Next time, they will even put a semicolon. So, yeah, complaining about how authentic how difficult the password is, and giving out the password at the same time, yeah, that's how you do it. That's how it's done. While the snafu is embarrassing, the actual impact of making such a password public is likely limited. Access to these computers at commentators' booths is likely restricted, especially because there is no public at the Olympics events due to COVID-19 risks. All right, yeah, but if we can figure out the IP address, who knows what you can do. All right, I think we're going to close things out tonight. You guys, Rob and Gila, anything you want to share, add, say?
Well, I have to go change the password on my computer, which is also booth 03. So, you know, thanks for the heads up there.
Okay, well, I'm glad we could warn you, Gila.
What he said, no, I actually had to send my supervisor her computer password yesterday. She said it's on a post-it in my office. Could you send it to me? And I said, sure. So, you know, that was super safe.
Wow. You just sent it, what, on a postcard? How did you send it to her?
Via email. She's actually working out of the country right now.
Uh-huh.
So I went into her office, read the post-it note with her password on it, and sent it.
And you didn't feel good about this, did you?
Not great, no.
Okay, well, let's see if we can figure out a way people facing similar situations might be able to deal with them. Did you have any other way of talking to this person besides email?
No, actually.
Text message? SMS? Nothing like that?
Not in that precise moment.
Okay.
I don't know if her cell phone is set up to work in the country that she's in right now.
Uh-huh.
And if she has a cell phone for that country, I don't have that information.
Did she have the ability to change the password?
She did say to me that she's working with the password that our IT department set up for her.
Uh-huh.
And she doesn't know why she hasn't changed it, because it's not one of her standard passwords. Like, honestly, that is probably the most secure password she has.
Uh-huh. And does she only have one email address?
No.
Oh, okay. There you go. That's the solution. So you send her a message saying on one email account saying, I'm going to send you your password, but it's going to be backwards. And then you send her the password, but you don't say it's the password. You just send her this string. She knows it's her password backwards. No one else does. Unless they're monitoring both mailboxes.
Right. All I'm saying
is... Or your mailbox.
Right. No, all I'm saying is because I had to stand with this person to set up her out-of-office message before she went on this trip,
mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if sending it to another email address would have provided the desired outcome, is all I'm saying.
Yeah, these are problems a lot of people face on a daily basis. But one of the solutions is, okay, here's your password, change it as soon as you get it. You know, if it's your password. If it's the password of a department, then it gets more tricky.
Yeah, this is just hers, but...
Wow. Well, I'm sorry you had to go through that.
It was rough going, but we're still... I have finally convinced my department not to send me full credit card numbers in emails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good idea. That's a good idea. unless you want to collect credit card numbers and go on a spree, there's really no reason to send those to you.
No, they... It was fascinating. I said, "You please do not send me full credit card numbers and CVV numbers and expiration dates via unsecured email. That's just a bad idea." And they said, "But why not?" And I said, "Don't do that." So I'm doing, you know, my little victory for security at my workplace, trying not to help people commit credit card fraud is my plan.
Yeah, and just, you know, basically having that personal information floating around is never a really good idea.
Nope, not even a little.
All right. Hey, did you guys have any I didn't really allow people to comment on the Virgil story that I was reading earlier, or I was talking about for the first half of the show earlier, and I wanted to know if anyone had anything they wanted to add or ask or anything like that.
The thing that interests me about it is, yes, we know that Virgil was not divulging any secrets. He was over in North Korea basically telling them the same thing that anybody in the field would have told them. But I also feel like he was arrested in 2019 for this.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, it's only 2 years ago. It doesn't seem like that long. But in the cryptocurrency world, like, it seems like now even the general public knows so much more about cryptocurrency than they did 2 years ago. It's much more of a mainstream subject that people tend to have some level of, like, at least an idea of what it is, versus 2 years ago when it was more of this magic future space money thing that people might not be as sure of. And so this does seem like another case of the powers that be not fully understanding something, just knowing that it could in some way be dangerous, and therefore let's find this guy and basically mitnick him.
Yeah. Oh, good. Good use of mitnick as a verb. Yeah, you know, it's in many ways, this is cryptocurrency on trial as well, because there is a lot of hostility towards it. There's a lot of fear of this unknown entity that came out of nowhere, out of thin air, as Trump said. And he shouldn't have to bear the brunt of that, because what he was doing. Yeah, we say he told them things. But he didn't go over there to tell them things. He went over there to attend a conference out of curiosity, to see North Korea out of curiosity. And during that, and the only reason I know this is because he told them this, a couple of people asked him some questions, and he provided very rudimentary answers, things that you could find on the internet. That's it. And, you know, I did the same thing when I was over there in North Korea. I wasn't talking about cryptocurrency. It didn't exist back then. But people asked me questions about, you know, my MP3 player. And I said, oh, this is how it works. I don't know if I was giving away any secrets there. But basically, the mentality right now seems to be, if you help a North Korean out in any way, you're hurting your own country, which is utter nonsense. I mean, I held the door for somebody in North Korea. Was I hurting my country by helping a North Korean in that context? It just seems like you can really distort this and make somebody suffer because you want to follow the letter of the law to absurd degrees. And, you know, when it's a friend of yours, when it's somebody you know so well, when you know how they express themselves and how they won't see something that maybe some of us will see as very, very obvious. Like, this is a bad idea. This is going to be used against you because people won't understand what your true motivation was. You know, it's really frustrating to see that happen, to see someone taken advantage of that way. And that's exactly what's happening to him right now.
Yeah, I think it's really short-sighted of the U.S. government in their position to look at this case as something that will actually be defining in in other realms, like export bans on cryptographic stuff or weapons and so forth. And it's a huge exaggeration. Even the things you referenced, I didn't even know about any of that. But the evangelizing is something that is just something Virgil's so passionate about. Anybody who was interested in learning about this was someone he wanted to teach and share and create understanding with. And in the future, as more and more people are coming into understanding this stuff, you have to be aware who's using it and have insight on how they're using it or how far along they've been. And he was willing to tell them he was willing to talk about his experience and what types of things people were asking him about. And it was quite interesting. And his case seems more like career goals for people that know they can get they will get a pass because there's so much fear. And ironically, from the government side, ironically, in a moment when, as Rob pointed out, so much of cryptocurrency has been validated by the markets, the private sector, hedge funds. Not only is the cryptocurrency Bitcoin listed on some of the finance news networks, but there are funds around cryptocurrencies where people can invest but not actually buy specific cryptocurrency. I mean, it's becoming so ubiquitous and so widely held that I find it it's a particularly insulting thing to take someone who was just being incredibly open, thinking he was talking to technical people who would appreciate what the future of this holds and what this means and how important it is to what's going on in the world right now, to be used in a way and exaggerated as though he has done something to threaten international affairs in some way, like actually participating in some transaction where the reality is the world itself is embracing the technology, and anyone who wants to further that discussion is a friend of Virgil's, especially. And I think that his voice being so loud about how important this technology is also part of that pass that the government's getting on this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is just so much, and I wonder if it's willful misunderstanding of the way he expresses himself, the things that he says and does. For instance, talking about how cryptocurrency can be used to evade sanctions and phrasing it in a way to make it sound like that's what he intended to do, when in actuality, what he was attempting was to theoretically prove how this could be defeated. Something he was sharing with everybody that he talked to, including the U.S. government. Don't you want to know how your system could be defeated? He wasn't showing the North Koreans how to do that. He was basically explaining this is what could happen with this particular science, with this particular technology. It's called research. It's called, security, investigation, the sharing of information. These are things that you should be embracing. Virgil should be teaching. He should be in front of a class or working in a department for the government. If he would do that probably sooner than I would, or any university that would basically value such a thing. Which up until now I thought was most of them, and now I'm not sure. The way that this has been kind of brushed under the rug and forgotten about, It's a tragedy. It's horrible that you have somebody of that caliber in a federal prison right now, literally for nothing, just because he's too smart. You don't understand him. You question his motivations. You don't look at his past. You don't look at his record. You don't look at all the things that he has done that are good. And yeah, okay, he's a little strange, perhaps. He expresses himself differently. He might seem like he's a smart aleck and knows a little too much. I think these are good things. I think that these are things that can help us all. Or you can destroy your life. We really need to to figure out what to do about this, because it's, I'm sure it's not the only case of its kind, but it's one that that affects somebody that I know quite well, I've known for some time. Yes, Rob.
And also just the idea that you can regulate talking about how something that exists in the world works. I think that goes against so much, maybe everything that the hacker community has ever stood for. I mean, like, I'm personally not interested at all in cryptocurrency. I think it's, I think it's got a lot to answer for. I'm not interested in using it myself, but I like hearing about how it works. I like hearing about the theory behind it and, the tech behind it. And like, it's a thing that exists in the world. And information about it is light. Information about anything is light. And as soon as you start telling people, you know, here's a thing that we're all dealing with, here's a thing that exists, you're not allowed to know how it works, that rankles my hacker senses. If you were looking at a car that somebody was driving around and you weren't allowed to look up how the engine worked or, you know, things like that, that would be ridiculous. But but in this case, because it's something that is not so well understood among the mainstream, that maybe governmental organizations feel threatens their power in some way, they start regulating it. And this is dangerous. This has never been a good idea, I don't think, this kind of censorship.
Yeah, regulation, that's one thing. We expect them to regulate things, but to punish people for knowing too much or, you know, for explaining something. For instance, you know, somebody write an article for 2600 about this very subject, and we printed it. And let's say we have a subscriber in North Korea. Well, aren't we doing the exact same thing by sending the magazine to them? They can read it. Or, you know, if somebody in North Korea is able to access the internet and read the same information, it's just mind-boggling to me that you're going to put all the weight onto one person for all the things that you fear. And the articles we read tonight prove that they already knew how to manipulate cryptocurrency in nefarious ways. So he wasn't showing them how to do that in any sense. If anything, he was learning more than they were. That's what I'm convinced. But he went over there to learn. He went over there to see the closest thing to another planet that we have here, because that's what North Korea is like when you visit there. And many, many hackers have visited North Korea because they're curious, and that's it. When Trump issued his decree making it illegal for Americans to go to North Korea, a lot of people didn't take it seriously. A lot of people didn't take Trump seriously. Now, I know that's a mistake. You should have. And there are penalties, and, you know, they're rarely enforced, but they do exist, and you're supposed to obey the rules. And Virgil has never said that he didn't do that. But when that rule was enforced, when the decree came down, it wasn't so much to punish North Korea as it was to protect American citizens. We had just had the instance where somebody had died or was severely injured in North Korea at the hands of North Korean security, or he came down with some horrible disease and died shortly after arriving back in the U.S. after they released him.
Otto Warmbier.
Yeah. So after that case, that is when Trump said, okay, Americans can't go there anymore for their own safety. And, you know, Virgil basically hadn't lived in the United States for years. He lived in Singapore, and, He did what I wouldn't have done. I wouldn't have asked permission. I would have just gone. You know, I wouldn't have felt like I even had to answer to anybody in the United States if I didn't live there for many years. But he didn't feel that way. He felt like, you know, he had ties to this country, and he should go and do it above board. Unfortunately, they didn't see it the same way. They said, no, you can't go. And in a lapse of judgment, he went anyway. Which, you know, doesn't really make much sense, because U.S. passports supposedly are invalid to get to North Korea. So somehow he hacked the system and got into a place he wasn't supposed to get. That's not worth throwing somebody in prison for, you know, maybe a fine or something like that. But you don't destroy somebody's life, not somebody like him. So I feel like it's an uphill battle now to make people understand why his life shouldn't be destroyed. But I feel this is something we need to get involved with, and especially with the trial coming up in September. I'm afraid of what they're going to do. I'm afraid of what's going to happen to him.
Yeah, it can't go in the direction without the
the correct characterization, you know, and a proper defense. And it just seems like a lot of stuff has been put up against getting the real characterization of who Virgil is and the like openness and intent behind his actions.
Yeah, I feel like anything any of us say in particular situations can be distorted to make it seem like we're somehow threats. And that's something, regardless of how you feel on this, I think that's something we all need to look at and realize, yeah, you know, that could have been me in a different context. I could have been, I could have my words distorted, misunderstood, portrayed in a particular way that is easy for people to believe and then be condemned by them and never really have a chance to express yourself to them. And that is what I'm worried about, that people won't understand. So I guess we'll be following the story in the weeks to come, and hopefully we can figure out how to get something done. If you want to help in any way or have advice or connections or anything, write to us, oth@2600.com. And I guess we're done for overtime tonight. Thanks to everybody who called in. Thanks to everybody who wrote in. And thanks to everybody who listened. And we'll see you again next week. Good night.
So long.